Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
You're listening to The Exchange. Here's today's show.
Welcome to The Exchange. I'm John Fort, in for Kelly Evans, and here's what's ahead. The bond market still keeping stock gains in check. This as we prepare to hear from Fed Chair Jay Powell this hour. We're going to bring you any headlines as we look at where to find opportunities across stocks, bonds, and commodities. Plus, office vacancy rates hitting a new 20-year high. We will look at the REITs setup and the potential winners and losers into earnings. This as tech layoffs continue to pressure that sector. Speaking of higher rates, housing starts posting the biggest drop in 4 years, but there is one name better insulated from high rates and better positioned to reap the benefits once rates start dropping. That's at least according to Jefferies. The analyst behind that call is here to make his case, but we begin with today's markets and Dom Chu with the numbers. Dom.
Trying to recover from that sell-off over the course of the last few days here, shorter term, and right now we're just about unchanged in the market overall. The broader S&P 500 is at 5060. It's down about 1 to 2 points, so pretty much call it flat on the session right now. At the highs, we were up a modest 8 points on the S&P and down 21 points at the lows. So again, the middle of that trading range, pretty much unchanged. Again, the level that we were watching before still remains just around 5116, 5115. On the upside, that is now the 50-day moving average. So a level that some traders are watching to see if it can recover there and get to above. But the Dow Industrial is up about 0.25%, 115 points to the upside. Pacing the advance, 37,851. Paying attention, though, United Healthcare on the heel of earnings is accounting for every little bit and more of the Dow's gains so far. So if not for UNH, the Dow would actually be negative right now. And the NASDAQ composite up about 6 points, just about flat in the session, 15,890. Interest rates, a key part of that discussion. John alluded to it in the open right over there. But look at across the yield curve. Pretty much every maturity in the U.S. sovereign bond market is lower in price and higher in yield. The two-year benchmark note yield, 4.97%. The 10-year, just a hair above 4.66%. And for those people who use the TLT ETF to trade in the government bond market, those shares have been on a decline over the medium term. It's now down about 0.2% after a 1% decline plus yesterday. So watch yields. And then the stocks of the day, it's the closeout, the winding down of big bang earnings season. And it's a tale of two different stock moves. Both Morgan Stanley and Bank of America reported better than expected results across most of their business units, if not all of them. But we're seeing a divergence. Morgan Stanley is still up about 3% off the session highs, but positive there. Bank of America, though, again, solid beat. However, some concerns for investors and some analysts about what the prospect for net interest income looks like for the coming months. So keep it on Bank of America, keep it on Morgan Stanley. Of course, John, we're all going to watch that big interview with Brian Moynihan and closing bell later on. So that's the state of play. I'll send things back over to you.
But of course, Dom, thank you. And talking about rates, the bond market keeps stocks in check still. One of my next guests says stocks can still move higher even if rates do stay higher for longer. The other guest is sticking with commodities instead. Let's bring in Peter Buchvar, Chief Investment Officer at Bleakley Financial Group and a CNBC contributor, and Jeff Krumpelman, Chief Investment Strategist at Mariner Wealth Advisors. Guys, welcome. Peter, I mean, look at these yields. It's got to have an impact on the equities market, right?
Well, you'd think from a multiple perspective, for sure, going into this recent rate move, the S&P 500 on a trailing basis got up to almost 25, 26 times earnings and forward about 21. That's rather rich for the rise in interest rates. And its economic impact, its earnings impact, depends on what side of the fence you're on. Are you a borrower? Do you need to refi? Are you looking to buy a house? Are you trying to finance a factory? Or on the other side, are you collecting nice interest income as a saver? Are you a boomer that wants to go on cruises? Well, you seem to be doing just fine.
Yeah. I mean, Polonius's advice, neither a borrower nor a lender be. The lender part's looking pretty good right now. Jeff, what moves are you making in this environment, given not only do rates not seem to be coming down anytime soon, but yields getting a little spike?
So, you know, we're still in, John, kind of hold your ground mode. And there's no specific theme that we see out there. What we do like is, you know, having active strategies that we manage. There really is correlations that are coming down. And you can even see that within the Magnificent Seven. They're moving in disparate kind of patterns. And that says that there's opportunity, and it's really based upon the fundamentals, the valuation, and the technical elements of these stocks. So we're maintaining a blend between growth and value. We find plenty of attractive opportunities within technology outside of the Magnificent Seven. And we really like within capital spending, the industrials look good as we re-onshore. The economy is holding up nicely. There's still opportunities within consumer. And, you know, we're poised and measured in our view. We had a target of 5,200 to 5,400 on the S&P, and we're kind of maintaining that. And it's hold your ground and look at those stocks that aren't priced at 30 times, unless they have 30% growth rates, and, you know, kind of enjoy the attractive fundamentals out there.
Okay, so, Peter, getting specific, you do remain bullish, gold and silver, and other commodity stocks, energy, industrial metals, uranium, agriculture. Why that specifically? And is there a danger in not believing in some of this technology stuff, right? The AI story that, yes, some stocks are pretty rich in their valuation, but isn't the story just starting to unfold?
No question. And it's going to be very exciting to see how companies use the technology as tools in terms of improving their productivity and improving their businesses and so on. Right now, we're sort of in the picks and shovels development phase. Let's see how and what the returns of investment are for the users of that. On the commodity side, well, the CRB index, and this ties into interest rates, this complicates the Fed's job. The CRB index yesterday closed at the highest level since August 2022. And I think that that commodity bull run still has a ways to go. And as you said, I've been very bullish on precious metals. It's finally getting a lift. I think silver is one of the more exciting things to own. Agriculture has lagged, but it's beginning to play catch up in terms of like the fertilizer stocks. But quietly, we know cocoa has ripped to the upside. Coffee all of a sudden is at a multi-year high. And the industrial metals just getting a lift from the whole EV excitement. But generally speaking, with all the money that's been invested in tech over the past 5 to 10 years, it was not invested in commodity production. So this is sort of a payback of all the lack of investment in that area to the benefit of technology. And now you have this supply-demand imbalance that's leading to higher commodity prices.
Jeff, we talk about tech all the time, so I'm going to try to keep it in a different direction. Healthcare and defense. Yeah. Let's start with defense because the state of the world is pretty troubling. You like Booz Allen there. Why?
So, you wanted to get away from tech, John. It's kind of hard to do that.
Yeah, not entirely.
It's really AI at reasonable price. And so they have a number of contracts with the government. But as they move towards AI and systems development, Booz Allen is an IT consulting company. And they're benefiting from rising backlog and new contract wins with the government to build out systems that use AI technology. So, sorry, you know, it's a way to diversify and to get this at reasonable price. As their estimates come up, you know, they're priced at very reasonable teens levels in terms of PE, and we think that's a good place to be.
And in healthcare with Dexcom and ResMed?
Yeah, you know, you've had Eli Lilly that all of a sudden, I guess, we're gonna cut half of our body weight through these obesity drugs. And what that's done for, if you're in sleep apnea like ResMed or diabetes and Dexcom, all of a sudden the world said, I guess we're going to have no more diabetes and everyone's going to sleep through the night. And we felt that that has created opportunity for these wonderful companies with, you know, medical equipment in those areas and devices for diabetes and sleep apnea. So, you know, good growth rates and on sale.
All right. Some of us will cut half our body weight, but not you, Jeff. You're doing okay. So, Peter, what do you do here strategically when you're thinking about how to make these moves in this market? It feels like one of those times where we're kind of trading sideways for a while. You could get complacent with your money in cash or in safer things, but historically, that's where investors miss out on opportunities. So how do you figure out when and where to get aggressive?
Well, that's always the most difficult thing, is trying to time the market, of course, but you know, the market rallied almost 10% in the first couple months of the year. That was just an unsustainable pace in terms of annualization of that. Sentiment got extraordinarily bullish, as measured by a few sentiment indicators that I look at. You tie that into this persistent rise in interest rates, valuations that I think leave no margin for error, that it's, if in the short term, I think it's only prudent to be prudent.
Right. Well, okay, we try to be prudent, then this market keeps running. Peter, Jeff, thank you.
Thanks, John.
Well, China's economy grew faster than expected in the first quarter, but the Hang Seng, along with the rest of the Asian markets, selling off with these ongoing tensions between Israel and Iran. My next guest, though, says contagion is limited as long as we don't get a spike in oil. WTI hovering right around the $85 a barrel mark right now. For more, let's bring in Dirk Willer, the head of emerging market strategy at Citi Research. Dirk, you know, we hear about perhaps oil not getting hit as we await Israel's response here, but how much of a risk is it?
Yeah, very good question. I think the first take of the market after the weekend was it will probably not escalate, at least not in a way that puts any oil production at risk and that puts the real risk of war between Iran and Israel on the table. And so the market relaxed a little bit. And I think that is the right view. And not the least because it was clearly demonstrated to us how important the U.S. really is for the defense of Israel. And the U.S., of course, has absolutely no interest to let this thing escalate. So they will use all the leverage they do have to keep things at a fairly manageable level. And that, of course, means, yes, you will not get an oil spike. While our oil status did upgrade the oil prices, it's really just to around current levels while for the risk premium to stick with us for a longer time period. But we don't see this spike to 100 plus that would cause more damage. Now, the tails have increased, right? The risks clearly have increased. If Netanyahu is basically pushed by his coalition partners to take a more hardline view, but it's not our base case. We think we can actually avoid that.
Well, even if we don't get a spike, does this risk in a way put a floor under oil?
Yes, I mean there are probably $4 to $5 of risk premium right now in oil, and that is higher than we would have thought some time ago. And that will probably stick with us at least for another quarter or two. In the end, fundamentals will take over. In the end, it will all be about how much oil demand is rising, how much supply is rising, and so forth. And we actually see oil coming off again, but probably only in Q3 when things could have calmed from current levels. And that is something we just have to live with for now, this risk premium in the oil price. You're very right about that.
So Q3 is just a quarter away from Q4, and then we're starting to talk about weather again, right, as an impact on energy. So how much room for volatility is there in that quarter before we start really talking about weather and nat gas and things?
Yeah. I mean, I think we will probably just stick around current levels unless there really is a big intensification between Israel and Iran. I mean, there could always be other issues with oil markets. You know, it's not just one conflict that can drive up oil prices. There are many of those. And so there's always in the oil market, I feel, the unexpected happens. But you know, we already moved quite a bit. We priced in a fairly severe situation. And I think we are fine for now. So from here, you would need an additional shock. And those things are obviously very hard to forecast. Oil is a volatile beast, of course, and anything can happen. But we are confident that we are in the right range for now and have priced a sufficient amount of risk.
How does natural gas look then at the same time, given that it also plays into some of these conflict narratives, probably more Russia-Ukraine?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think the important thing to realize, though, is that from a local macro perspective, especially when it comes to the U.S., oil just matters a lot more because the natural gas market has become more international through liquefied gas. But it's still the case that it's a more regional market. And so the impact of the U.S., it's really all about the oil, and nat gas will play a second fiddle. And so I think the market rightly focuses on what this conflict means for oil first and foremost.
Well, we talked about Q3, mentioned Q4. By Q1 of next year, we'll have clarity on who's going to be in the White House for 4 years. How much of an impact is that going to have on either domestic production or at least the narrative around it? Because the U.S. is still producing a lot of oil, even though about half the country thinks maybe not.
Yeah, I mean, the election is important in this respect in many ways, not just the policy towards oil producers, but also there's clearly a question how will relationships with Saudi Arabia change? Will OPEC Plus be maybe more willing to help a different administration out with production increases? Will the policy towards Israel change? So there are many, many components that go into this election. And they're really not that easy to sort of compartmentalize in terms of what is what. But just in terms of the production response, yes, you're obviously right. The normal playbook is that for Republican presidencies, the oil and gas sector does quite well. And we could certainly see some of that.
Finally, emerging markets, given the geopolitical turmoil out there, are there plays or too much risk?
In emerging markets, I would say in this particular instance, it's a very sort of regional impact. So yes, we do think some of the Israeli credits probably should price a little bit more risk. So that is true. And maybe some parts of GCC, but it already becomes quite weak unless we do go back to this big oil spike. So in a sense, my view is if everything goes according to plan, so it stays a sort of localized conflict without a big oil spike, we go back to trading fundamentals, we'll trade again the Fed story, and that is really important for emerging markets. So the reason that the emerging market carry trade pulls back today is much more U.S. rates rather than geopolitics or anything. So if we can stabilize in U.S. rates, then things will improve in emerging market land again very quickly.
All right. If everything goes according to plan, it'll be the first time.
Right.
Dirk Willer, thank you.
Why wouldn't it?
Coming up, a C-suite view on the impact of higher rates with the CEO of BNY Mellon, the bank posting record revenue, but not ruling out the possibility of further rate hikes from the Fed. We're going to ask him why later on in the show. But first, big tech is getting smaller, downsizing its office footprint at least, and dealing with another blow to the commercial real estate sector. We're going to look at names and cities that are most at risk next when The Exchange comes right back.
This is The Exchange on CNBC.
From their innovative practice facility to unmatched views from the fairway, the PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with 5G solutions from T-Mobile for Business. Together, we're using AI-powered analytics to expand coaching tools and bringing fans closer to the pros with 5G-connected cameras. This is game-changing innovation. This is the PGA of America with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
Welcome back to The Exchange. Demand for commercial real estate is still sluggish, with U.S. vacancies at 20-year highs, according to CBRE. And our next guest says big tech layoffs aren't helping. Joining me now is Steve Sakwa, senior equity research analyst covering REITs at Evercore ISI. Steve, welcome. I keep hearing that there is sort of a richer and poorer story in commercial real estate, and in office particularly. The newest kind of Class A is still filling up nicely, but the older stuff not getting as much demand. Is that so?
Yeah, thanks, John. Yeah, that is true. We are seeing a real bifurcation in quality really across all the cities, and newer products are certainly leasing up much better. They're certainly holding their rental rates much better. And tenants and companies want to bring their employees back into, you know, highly amenitized space in new buildings really across the country.
So then what happens to the old stuff?
Well, that's a really good question. Some of it's, you know, going to get repurposed into other types of real estate. In some cases, it may be able to get converted into residential. That's starting, but it's going very slow. In other cases, it may get completely knocked down and repurposed into to other things. Could be hotels, could be retail. But, you know, in some cases, it's just not going to function as office space going forward.
How long does that take to play out, given that capital continues to be expensive and higher for longer means it's probably going to be expensive for longer? Does it get easier for potential investors to pencil out exactly how much those expensive conversions are worth spending on, how long it's going to take for them to make money?
It's going to take a while. So this is a long process, and the cost basis for the new buyers has to be cheap enough where they can, you know, buy a building, get the right basis, then invest a fair amount of capital, and then get an appropriate return. And to your point about higher interest rates and higher costs, the investors have to make an adequate return on that investment. And so either rents have to go up on the other things that they're trying to convert it into, or the cost basis of that building has to come down to make it cheap enough for them to get in to make the adequate return. So one way or another, you know, the returns have to pencil for the new investors. And, you know, that's just a slow process. And then you've also got regulation in different cities about time to convert and the process to convert. So it's happening, but it's happening very slowly.
Are we yet seeing that real capitulation on price in these older buildings that so many have been concerned about, and concerned that some of that's going to hit regional banks, right, when we've got some of these loans on their books? Have we yet seen that, since that's sort of what it might take to help with the cost basis on these conversions, but it would cause some pain for the people who were in them before?
Yeah, so you are starting, and you have seen the banks taking more charge-offs and write-downs for their commercial real estate book, and that's certainly been a concern in the marketplace really for the better part of a year now. Certainly since Silicon Valley Bank had their problems, you know, over a year ago, we've seen increasing charge-offs and write-offs from the banks. So, you know, that's happening, and in some cases they are foreclosing on assets from borrowers who can't make debt service, and they're taking those back, and then, you know, they're having to turn around and remarket them and sell them. So, as I said, it's an ongoing process. It's not one that's going to happen, I would say, very quickly. But we're probably looking at another 12, 18, 24 months of this, you know, taking place in order to kind of right size some of these problems.
What's big tech doing? We've been hearing layoff headlines out of big tech for a while. And then there's the whole hybrid remote work thing that was going on there. But then certain cities seem to be coming back somewhat. Seattle, when Amazon said everybody back in the office, you really saw small business around downtown pick up. Are those things balancing out, or is it still a major drag in the areas where tech had really pushed into office over the past 5-10 years?
Well, look, tech was the huge driver of office demand going back several years. And whether it was in Seattle, San Francisco, New York, Austin, Texas, you know, big tech was clearly leading the charge on office usage and leasing activity. And, you know, they were in effect pre-committing to hires that ultimately did not get hired. And so they found themselves long too much space, and they're putting some of that space back on the sublease market. But I think the return to office is really unfolding. And I think today, you know, there's less talk about just pure hybrid work or, you know, people working fully remote, and they are back in the office certainly more. You've seen that come down from big tech over the last 6 to 9 months. And that's certainly good for small businesses in and around the office buildings. I think today the bigger issue on the leasing front is really the economic uncertainty and the fact that interest rates have been extremely volatile, and, you know, C-suites in large companies can't really make decisions about where the economy's heading. And I think ultimately that's probably a bigger factor today than the return to office discussion.
Okay, now that we've thoroughly set the table, let's eat. When it comes to the REITs specifically that you like and that you don't like, what do you like, what do you not like in the REITs?
Well, we like different things across different subsectors. So, you know, we've got, you know, like in the residential space, we like Avalon Bay on the residential side. We like Federal Realty in the shopping center space. We like Healthpeak in the healthcare area. And even in office, you know, we've got a few buys where we think the balance sheets are good and the assets are good, such as the Boston properties, Cousins, and you know, corporate office defense property. So we do have buys across a couple of different subsectors, and we are, you know, being careful about leverage and balance sheets within the space given the rising rates.
All right, but Vornado and SLG, SL Green, not so much.
At this point, John, I'd say we're worried more about kind of the balance sheet since where some of those valuations stacked up against some of the other things that we do like. So, you know, every stock has a kind of a price and an entry point. But, you know, we think there were other places that we'd rather be in the short term.
Sounds good. Steve, thanks. Steve Sakwa from Evercore ISI. Now coming up, AMD, one of the worst performing names in the VanEck semiconductor ETF over the past month, trying to avoid its first three-week losing streak since October. But one Wall Street firm is turning bullish today, forecasting a 40% rally in that stock. We're going to tell you why straight ahead.
From their innovative practice facility to unmatched views from the fairway, the PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with 5G solutions from T-Mobile for Business. Together, we're using AI-powered analytics to expand coaching tools and bringing fans closer to the pros with 5G-connected cameras. This is game-changing innovation. This is the PGA of America with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Good afternoon and welcome back to The Exchange. I'm Tyler Matheson with your news update at this hour. Voting technology company Smartmatic and far-right network One American News have reached a settlement over the network's lies about the 2020 election. Both parties confirmed that confidential settlement, ending Smartmatic's defamation lawsuit against OAN. Dubai International Airport said it diverted arriving flights until weather conditions improved after nearly 4 inches of rain fell over a 12-hour period in the United Arab Emirates on Tuesday, what Dubai normally gets in a year. This is according to data from the UN. The storm flooded out major highways, suspended operations at the airport for nearly 30 minutes, while in neighboring Oman, the death toll from flooding rose to 18. And Cowboy Carter is giving jeans and cowboy boots a new life. Beyoncé's first country album features the song Levi's Jeans. And according to retail data tracking firms, store traffic at Levi's locations increased 20% the week of the album's release. And elsewhere, sales of Western-style boots were up 24% the same week. John, expect to see you in your boots soon.
It might happen, Tyler. It's a demographics thing. I haven't seen black people this excited about country music in a long time.
No. Back to you, John.
Coming up, there are still a million things banks haven't done. BNY Mellon, America's oldest bank, founded by Alexander Hamilton, is the first to deploy an AI supercomputer powered by NVIDIA. We're going to ask the CEO about that, their results, and new $6 billion buyback program after this break. And we're only 2 days away from the inaugural CNBC Changemakers event in New York City this Thursday, April 18th. We will hear from some of the women transforming business, including Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo. To request an invite, you can scan the QR code on the screen or go to cnbcevents.com/changemakers. We'll be right back. The Exchange, the KBW Bank Index on pace for its fourth negative session in five, and about 8% off the 52-week high it hit less than 3 weeks ago as earnings weigh. Bank of New York Mellon, one of today's worst performing holdings, down about 2%, despite reporting the highest quarterly revenue in its 240-year history in Q1. Shares unable to hold on to earlier gains after the bank reiterated full-year guidance, saying it expects a near 10% drop in net interest income from the previous year.
Joining now from BNY Mellon headquarters in downtown Manhattan is CEO Robin Vince, along with CNBC's own Leslie Picker. Leslie.
Hey, John, you're right. We are here in the HQ of BNY Mellon, the nation's oldest lender. We actually have some memorabilia back here, which is the first ever loan to the U.S. government, $20,000 back then. The debt has risen significantly in the years since then. But Robin, we appreciate you being here on this earnings day. Highest quarterly revenue ever in that 240-year history, thanks to gains in market values, client activity as well, offsetting some declines in net interest income from the balance sheet mix. How would you characterize client behavior at this juncture?
Well, first of all, thanks for being with us. As you pointed out, we've got some fun history around us today. That warrant that you were just pointing to, warrant number one, it is, in fact, the origin story of the U.S. national debt, the first ever piece of debt of the United States. So I think as I look at us and our performance this quarter, we're really quite pleased. We think we had a very solid earnings, as you pointed out, a high on an operating basis, at least from a revenue point of view. And our focus has really been to drive forward our company, which 240 years old today, but still innovating. And that's been our focus as we look to serve our clients in new and different ways. In fact, that's one of our strategy pillars, being more for our clients.
And how would you describe those clients right now in terms of their behavior as they look ahead to, you know, the potential likelihood of a soft landing as, you know, the rate complex has shifted higher in the last few weeks? What are they doing with their money?
Well, it's a complicated world today. We have, of course, all of the geopolitical control sort of issues that we've seen most recently over the course of the weekend with everything unfolding in the Middle East. So that's been an issue. We clearly have elections around the world. Those will continue to be provide some uncertainty for investors. But in the U.S., at least, we have this underlying strength to the U.S. economy, which I think has surprised many people. We've had this view that there are probably going to be less rate cuts this year than many market practitioners were suggesting, at least earlier in the year. And I think we're seeing that that inflation is a little stickier, but it's sticky in a way for quite good reasons, which is this underlying health to the economy. And that's causing clients to need help navigating the world. And so that uncertainty cascades into their behavior.
And I want to dig into that a little bit more, but I have to just take a quick break because we have Steve Liesman with some breaking news on Chairman Powell.
Thanks, Leslie. Chairman Jay Powell at a conference being with the Central Banker of Canada saying that recent data have not given the Fed greater confidence to cut interest rates. He says it's taking longer than expected to achieve that confidence in order to bring down rates. Goes on to say the Fed can maintain the current rate of restrictions for as long as needed. The performance of the U.S. economy, he says, has been quite strong. Recent data shows a lack of further progress on inflation this year. But the labor market, he says, is moving into better balance, even amidst ongoing strength. Broader wage pressures are moderating gradually, but the 12-month core PCI was little changed in March, according to his estimates. I guess that's we're talking about the one that's coming up. The Fed took a cautious approach to not overreact to declines last year. Recent data have not provided that confidence. Leslie, back to you.
Thank you, Steve. And that's the perfect actual segue to the next question, which is how this recent rate volatility changes your expectation for net interest income and the broader macro environment through the rest of the year. I saw in a recent interview you said that a rate hike is not impossible.
That's right. I don't think it's impossible. That underlines our approach to business generally, which is we're in the preparedness business. We think that resilience is an incredibly important part of how we operate. That resilience allows our clients to go about their business every day. And that's obviously the core of what we do, which is to serve our clients. But you're right. I think there's a possibility. I don't think it's the base case that we would see the Fed raise rates. But if we had incredible continued strength and stickiness in inflation, you can't completely rule it out. It's also possible that we won't get any rate cuts. I think it's still the base case that we will get some rate cuts. But as you just heard from Chair Powell, the data has not yet given them the comfort that they're looking for to actually move forward in that direction. It's not super surprising. If you think about all of the underlying tailwinds that the U.S. economy is benefiting from right now, you have investor confidence, money coming into the United States. You have people wanting to build factories in the United States. We've just had over the past few days. Additional industrial policy, essentially giving money to build chips fabs here in the United States. We have the dividends that are coming off money market funds, $6.5 trillion, 5% yield. The math says $300 billion in terms of dividends coming off that. That's a percentage point of GDP. 60% of Americans are invested in the stock market. We have $25 trillion in 401ks and IRAs for Americans. They've been seeing successive highs in the stock market over the course of this year. That gives confidence. That's part of what's driving spending. And we've just seen in recent data that spending's been doing quite well, surprising to the upside. So there are these underlying strengths to the economy, which is really powering that. It's not particularly surprising to hear Fed Chair Powell say what he said.
Yeah, fiscal spending, as well as, you, to your point, the flywheel effect from the broader markets. You did in the quarter take some reserve increases due to commercial real estate exposure. And I'm curious what kind of color you can share about your CRE book and how it's weathering higher for longer rates, various demographic shifts at this point in time. I know you said on the call, kind of so goes the 10-year, so goes the market, especially in 2025.
So our CRE book is really pretty small. We're a very modest commercial real estate lender. We have a modest amount of office. And so we don't really view that as a particular story as far as we're concerned as a firm. We have a very liquid balance sheet. We're a balance sheet light business. We're into the capital return services platforms. That's kind of the nature of who BNY Mellon is. But you're mentioning a response that I gave in the context of the broader market. And I think as we look at the commercial real estate, certainly clients and other participants in the market, you have to see the wall of refinancing that does come over the course of the next couple of years. That doesn't really tie to the overnight Fed funds rate. Those borrowers are going to be looking to where are 5-year rates, 7-year rates, even 10-year rates. And so over the course of the past 2 or 3 months, we've had a bit of a march higher in those rates. And refinancing for those borrowers will look different at a 4.5 to 5% rate, different than it would be if it was 4% or 6% or 7%. We don't predict those higher numbers, but you can't completely rule them out.
As you mentioned, a hike is possible. You know, we've talked about the history here. I want to also talk about the future, because you recently announced that you would be the first global bank to deploy an AI supercomputer powered by NVIDIA products. What are the use cases for those, and what are the safeguards that you plan to implement to make sure that the AI systems are functioning and safeguarding the use cases that you have?
Well, yeah, NVIDIA announced that that we were the first bank to deploy one of those super pods. Look, I think that AI is going to be a very important change to the world of commerce, to the world, but also to the financial services industry. If I look at it through the three lenses of our strategy here at the company, being more for our clients, it's going to help clients be able to see things and understand their data in ways that they couldn't previously understand. We have software in market, for instance, that helps clients avoid settlement issues in the post-trade market space. That's making life better for them, more efficient for them. We also look at it through a lens of running our company better, which for us, it means how do we create more efficiency? How do we help employees to be able to spend their time doing things that are more rewarding for them? How do we help our employees be able to be more productive? And the use cases there are being able to get a head start on the day, be able to take large amounts of information, distill it down. So there are so many things. I think this will ultimately be a benefit both from a revenue point of view and some expense savings, but also from a cultural point of view, helping our people be able to spend their time doing the things that they want to be able to do.
And real quickly, because we're almost out of time, but you have 50,000 employees. Does AI make your workforce larger or smaller?
I think fundamentally, AI helps our workforce to be more productive and more connected, spending their time on the things that are actually adding more value to them and to our clients.
Okay, we'll be watching. I know you said it's probably not a 24 thing, maybe a 25 thing and in the future. So we really appreciate you taking the time on this busy earnings day to be with us. Robin Vince, CEO of BNY Mellon. John, I'll send it back to you.
All right, Leslie, thank you. Very comprehensive. And we're going to hear from another bank CEO in less than a couple of hours. Bank of America's Brian Moynihan will join Scott Wapner on Closing Bell. That's today, 3 p.m. Eastern. Don't miss it. The exchange will have more from Fed Chair Powell after this quick break. Welcome back. We've got more headlines from Fed Chair Powell. Steve Liesman is back, along with CNBC contributor Peter Bukvar, who didn't quite get out of the building. Lucky for us. Steve, you were just reporting that Chair Powell is supposed to be talking about Canada, but he says the Fed does not have the confidence to cut rates in the foreseeable future, can stay here as long as needed as this economy remains hot. Inflation is stubborn, but the labor market seems fine. I mean, I thought he was talking about Canada.
He could have stuck to Canada, but he came out of the box. He had something to say about interest rates and inflation, and he's not happy. I mean, I think that's the way to think about it. And he's not happy, then Fed probabilities and bond yields are not happy. I guess the stock market probably looks like it came back from an initial brief sell-off there. But what he's saying is he does not have the confidence. He said that inflation is not running the way they thought it was going to run. It's running hotter than they expected. And this is not giving him the confidence to cut. I don't believe he's taking cuts off the table. There was an interesting comment this morning from Vice Chair Jefferson, where he did not discuss cutting interest rates. He said that current rates, if left where they are, should be enough to bring down inflation. But he left out a little thing he had in the last time he spoke, which was, we expect it will be okay to cut it sometime soon. That's not there. I didn't hear actually Powell talking about that. It doesn't mean it's off the table. What it does mean, I think, is the probabilities are now, I'm looking at what I think is probably an all-time low for the June contract probability at just 16%. And more interesting is the falling July probabilities just now at 40%. And they're starting to work on September a little bit, John, at 65%. That had been, all of those had been quite a bit higher. There was a time, probably not too long ago, that June was trading near 100% probability of a rate cut. That's off the table. Under 50% on July. Starting to think a little about September now, too.
Peter, when the show started, I think the 10-year was at 4.67-ish. It looks like on these remarks it spiked up to 4.69. Now it's back down 4.676. How does this change the calculus, if at all?
I still think that the 10-year is going back to retest that 5% level that we saw last year. You know, when you think about Powell, he celebrated New Year's with the 2-year inflation break even at 2%. He thought he was coming into this year.
Are we now 290?
We're at 290. And you have commodity prices that are at 20-month highs. So you talk about him wanting to establish confidence. This doesn't give you confidence that it's the right time to cut.
No, and just to underscore what Peter's saying, I'll keep going. You have the market-based measures of inflation expectations and the survey-based measures. Both of those are going up. So either way they look at it, this game for the hearts and minds of the public and the markets for the outlook for inflation is slipping a little bit.
And to clarify for people, it's kind of like the Stave Puff Marshmallow Man in Ghostbusters. If you think about it too much, it happens with inflation, right? So if people are expecting inflation, that means they're willing to pay more, they end up paying more.
And that's why they pay so much attention to expectations. But that's when you're talking about consumer expectations, it's definitely a focus. But I think we need to see the hard numbers rather than what someone feels.
Right.
You want to see what's in reality.
I do think we need to take a moment to acknowledge the first ever comparison of inflation expectations to the Marshmallow Man in Ghostbusters. I think that's an important cable historic moment. But that is right. And what I'm looking at right now is the market's expectation. Guys, do you have that January 2025 Fed funds contract? I use that to see what the market's expecting for the full year. And now they still have two cuts built in at 494. They haven't really started working on that yet, but we'll see. There's the probabilities right there, which are shrinking now, the opposite of what the Marshmallow Man did in Ghostbusters. And I think what we're doing is we have to hunker down now. This April 26, I believe, PCE report, Peter, is the one that Powell intimated that's not going to provide much assistance for the effort to reduce inflation. So January, February, and March are kind of off the table. Think about, I like the wrestler analogy, John, which is if he's down, the referee starts counting one, two. If he gets back up, you got to start counting again. That's where we are on inflation, I think, right now.
All right. We'll keep stretching those metaphors. Steve, Peter, thank you.
Thanks.
Well, housing starts falling nearly 15% in March. It's the biggest monthly decline since April 2020 as a resurgence in mortgage rates keeps buyers on the sidelines. But my next guest says there's one stock in the real estate universe that can not only withstand those higher rates, but will also benefit when buyers get some relief. And that is Zillow. Joining me now is senior internet analyst John Colantoni at Jefferies. He recently made Zillow, his top pick. John, why can Zillow buck this trend?
Yeah, thanks for having me. So we see tailwinds from a series of new products that Zillow is going to be rolling out over the next few years, driving over 20% upside to street estimates. And I think what's important here is that while Zillow is well positioned to benefit from a recovery in the housing market, that's not what's embedded in our base case assumptions here. So what we think is we think of Zillow as a self-help story. It's not a housing market recovery story. We think of the housing market recovery happening over the next few years as a potential driver of even further upside. And I think what's really compelling about this story is that this business has very low variable costs. So if we're right and there is significant upside to street revenue estimates, there's even greater upside to street profit estimates.
In this environment where inventories for residential real estate have been low and there's been more reliance on the rental market, how important is that segment of Zillow's business where property owners are able to market their properties as rentals, even manage them through that software? Does that matter, or is it mainly that core business that has you excited about Zillow still?
Yeah, I mean, it's mattering more and more. Zillow is focusing more on their rental offering than they ever have before. And I think specifically what they're focused on is the multifamily side of things. So think of these as big buildings with 100 plus units in it. They're going after that market. They have the most traffic in the rental space, and it's growing very quickly. In fact, it grew over 50% year on year in the fourth quarter. That's one of the four major drivers of upside that we see. So Zillow is creating an ecosystem of services around the housing market, the core business focused on the residential side. Then there's the rental side. There's a mortgage side. There's a variety of things that they're working on where they can benefit sort of across the entire ecosystem. That's something that we certainly like about the business.
So how do you measure their potential there versus, say, CoStar Group, which has Apartments.com, also focused on multifamily and those tools?
It's a big market, and there's room for two very successful players here. There's over 5 million multifamily properties in the United States. Zillow has slightly over 30,000 today. So it's a big market for both of them to go after. There's plenty of room for both of them to succeed.
Okay. And no risk from Zillow from these changing rules over real estate agents and what they can charge?
This is actually really interesting. This, I think, we're a little bit controversial here. We actually think the weakness in Zillow's shares since the settlement was announced actually makes for a compelling entry point because we don't think it will impact fundamentals. We think the internet age, it makes it easy for agents to continue sharing commission splits on platforms off of the MLS, like the brokers' websites, for example, which they're already doing. We think as long as they can find out how much they're going to get compensated, whether it's on the MLS or another platform, the current incentive structure remains in place, and we don't all see right. pressure to buy something.
Interesting. John Colantoni, thank you. Well, that's going to do it for the exchange, but I'll see you in just a little bit on Overtime at 4 p.m. Earnings from United Airlines, J.B. Hunt, Interactive Brokers. We're going to talk to Interactive Brokers Chairman Thomas Peterffy before his call with analysts. And Power Lunch is up after this quick break.
You've been listening to The Exchange. Make sure you're subscribed to get each episode every day, same time, same place.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. FedEx Ground service is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.